Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz, and I'm joined by Lahav Harkov. And Lahav, I think I'm going to start this week with maybe something a bit dramatic. You'll tell me if I'm over-dramatizing this. But on Sunday, I think we start what is the period known as the 3 weeks, right? Which is the run-up to the fast day of Tisha B'Av, which marks the destruction of the two Jewish temples back a couple thousand years ago. But anyhow, one of the things that led up to that, if I recall correctly, was the burning of the storehouses or the warehouses that each side in this dispute between the different Jewish sides that were warring with each other at the time, and that led to this lack of unity and division among the people, then led to the Greeks and to conquering and to destroying or whoever it was, right? But what do you learn from that is that you're attacking one another ends up leading to the division, ends up leading to also an external enemy to taking advantage of that division. And why do I mention this? Because I think what we've been seeing over the last week and a half now, almost 2 weeks since this new government has been sworn in, is a new leader of opposition, and who is also happens to be a former prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, who is pretty much saying, let's burn the place down, right? And what do I mean by that? He, at the same day that this new government was sworn in, which was last Sunday, he, in his speech, responding to Bennett's speech, already there started to disclose confidential conversations he had had with top U.S. officials, including the Secretary of Defense, to kind of use that to slam the new Bennett-Lapid government. And just the other day, again at the Knesset, he basically sacrificed again Israeli-U.S. relations, talking about how the promise that Lapid indicated that he had made to U.S. Secretary of State Blinken that Israel would not make any surprises, would not surprise the U.S., and the U.S. would not surprise Israel, is a sign of weakness and is something that could be detrimental to the state of Israel, even though it's something that he himself had done. So you just kind of see like Netanyahu saying, Israel-U.S. ties, yeah, the most important thing for Israel in the world, who cares? If I'm not there, no one gets to enjoy it. And to me, that's bad.
Yeah, I have, I guess, two responses to that. First of all, Netanyahu for a long time has sort of had this attitude that only he can really protect Israel, that he is uniquely qualified to do so, which you could agree with him, you could not agree with him. But what he seems to be doing is setting out to prove that by trying to sabotage the new government. I mean, there's being in opposition, which is fine. And then, you know, actively trying to drive a wedge between this government and the new administration in Washington, which is not normal, let's say, which is what he seems to be doing. Now, I think it's going to backfire on him. I think that the more Bibi tries to sort of, again, drive a wedge, the more of like a embrace Washington and Jerusalem will have for each other, because I think the Biden administration wants this new government to succeed, because it wasn't so easy for them working with Netanyahu, even though both sides were sort of making the best of it over the past few months. The other thing is that, Netanyahu said this thing about no surprises, that Lapid had and Blinken had agreed to no surprises. And Netanyahu said that that's dangerous, that, you know, sometimes the United States, we can't let that it would let the U.S. limit us in the actions that we take to defend ourselves. Which, when you look back historically, right, this no surprises is sort of an Israeli version of no daylight, which was sort of the motto of the U.S.-Israel relationship in more recent decades. And then President Obama changed his mind and said, no, we need more daylight. Now, if you read the book Ally by Michael Oren, who was the ambassador to the U.S., appointed by Netanyahu and representing the Netanyahu government's policies, you can read in that memoir that the Israeli government was actually very upset that Obama wanted greater daylight between them. In other words, Netanyahu was pretty good with a no surprises policy. At the same time, I actually heard Michael Oren speaking on the radio, and he said that there were some problems with no daylight and that certain things that Israel was planning to do were leaked to the American media in those years. He was a 2009 to 2013, I believe he was ambassador. So certain things leaked to the U.S. media in that time. And then, you know, Israel had to sort of reassess what they were sharing with the Obama administration or not. And let's be fair, like, okay, the new government can do the same thing. If they feel that the Biden administration is leaking things, I have not heard of any case of that in the last few months, but if it happens, they can also reassess. And the third point is, when I, after Netanyahu said this, I talked to someone very close to Yair Lapid, a close advisor of his. And the advisor said, you know, after a while, people are going to have to get used to the fact that Netanyahu is the opposition leader. And that newspapers don't necessarily cover what the opposition leader says every day with bated breath, the way we all jumped on this statement from Netanyahu, and that, you know, we should take it in proportion.
I think the final point is actually interesting, because I can tell you that as editor of the newspaper for years, with Lapid as head of opposition, I would constantly get complaints from his people. How come Lapid's not at the top of the website? How come Lapid's photo is not on the front page of the newspaper? How come Lapid's not getting the same status or space, I would say, as prime minister? And I think we kind of all know the answer, right? The head of the opposition, what he says, yes, has value in a democracy, of course, but it's not going to carry with it the same weight and impact and influence as what someone who is the prime minister, or the foreign minister for that matter, is saying and weighing in on an issue. But one other point, though, that's for sure. But one other point, what you said before, is that I also saw a publication that Gabi Ashkenazi, who served as foreign minister under Netanyahu, also said in a meeting back in March with Israeli ambassadors that he had reached an agreement also with the United States that neither country would surprise one or the other. And that was while Netanyahu was still prime minister. So this idea of daylight and
surprises. Yeah, so I was able to confirm that. It's true. Yeah.
So this idea is not necessarily a new idea. And by the way, you know, the example that Netanyahu gave when he spoke of, you know, if Menachem Begin had spoken to Reagan at the time and revealed what was happening with the Osirak reactor, which, by the way, this week is 40 years to that famous strike in 1981 when Israel destroyed Saddam Hussein's nuclear reactor outside of Baghdad. The Americans never would have let Israel do it, and we would have had a Saddam Hussein with nuclear weapons, which Begin did not do, of course, and Begin attacked, surprising the Reagan administration. But I do fast forward with you to 2007, when Ehud Olmert was prime minister and brought intelligence to the Bush administration about a nuclear reactor in Syria, asked the Bush administration and the president to attack. The president said no, said, let's take it to the Security Council. Olmert said, no, I'm going to attack, and you please just stay quiet and don't do anything, which Bush did. Israel went ahead and attacked, and we know the rest of that story. So you can also reveal stuff and coordinate it. And it's not the end of the world, right? It's about relationships. It's about alliances. It's about keeping those strong ties together.
Yeah. And again, like, I think, you know, okay, there's different presidents and different administrations, and we need to be able to sort of be flexible and assess things as we move forward. And it seems like Netanyahu is treating the Biden administration like it's Obama number two. And I understand that, because a lot of the officials in the administration were also in the Obama administration. But I think that in many ways, the Biden administration is trying to show Israel that it's not Obama number two, that it wants a less confrontational relationship with Israel, even though, and this is a very big even though, they want to return to the Iran deal, and that is something Israel sharply opposes.
So I want to ask you, you know, we've seen Bennett now. He's been prime minister for just about a week and a half. So difficult, obviously, to evaluate everything. But even on the point of the U.S., so he's made some tough comments and basically is continuing the same tough talk on Iran and the warnings about the return to the Iran deal. But I'm wondering how you see that first meeting that's going to take place between Bennett and Biden. We don't yet know when, but there's assumptions it might be sometime in the coming months, over the summer possibly even, that Bennett will be invited to the White House. And I think we can agree that the Americans are going to prepare very well for this trip, and they're going to want to give him a real red carpet welcome, give him a bear hug, roll out the red carpet, and really try to embrace the new government. They want it to survive, and they want to be able to get Bennett to come on board on issues like Iran, like the Palestinians. You know, Netanyahu's not that wrong in yes, warning that the prime minister of Israel does need to stand strong. And the question is how Bennett will maneuver all of that.
After speaking to some of Bennett's closest advisors and different people who understand Bennett's thinking, Bennett is going to be looking very closely at President Rivlin's trip to the White House next week. Bennett sees himself and Rivlin as having a lot of things in common. They both come from the right wing. They both oppose a two-state solution, but they are trying to work with the left and not sort of and be a uniting figures. So Bennett wants to see how the Biden administration will sort of handle and respond to Rivlin when Rivlin suggests things that more go towards the phrase now is minimizing the conflict as opposed to ending the conflict with the Palestinians. And so I think that that will be an indicator. Now, the fact is that the Biden administration has really been pushing for Rivlin to come. They invited him in March already, and the trip had been delayed, which some have said is because Netanyahu wasn't giving it the green light. And they still want Rivlin to come. And Rivlin's coming, I believe it's 10 days before he finishes his term as president, even though, you know, the president-elect, Isaac Herzog, has more in common with Biden's views when it comes to the Palestinians, certainly. So the fact that they still want to really roll out the red carpet for Rivlin is, I think, a sign that they are willing to work closely, and not just willing, they're, you know, really pushing for it, to work closely with whoever's in charge now, even if their views don't 100% align.
You know, I think it'll definitely be interesting to see how that trip goes. And I think that the Biden administration is signaling also with the Rivlin visit. And so far what we've seen, you know, that quick phone call that he made to Bennett after he was sworn in as prime minister last week, that they do want to find a way to work with this new government. Lahav, just give us kind of these past 10, 11 days of this government. You know, so besides for the diplomatic and that fight, that little squabble with Bibi, have they done anything big? I mean, there was the Mehron Commission of Inquiry, which they announced, they voted on in the cabinet. But so far, it just seems like a lot of optimism from everyone I talk to. But tachlis, as we say, not much yet.
Well, there's not that much you could do in 10 days, right? But last week we talked a lot about the flag march and that they had, I think, a pretty good response to that. Although there's still, fires in Israel's south from various incendiary devices, balloons and other things that are being sent over from terrorists in Gaza. And that needs to be dealt with. But, everyone's still kind of getting settled. Yair Lapid claimed that the last government just left everything in total chaos that they need to sort of recover from. And they're also dealing with a big controversy in the Knesset. There's this law, it's called the Family Reunions Law, which basically means that if an Israeli marries a Palestinian, the Palestinian cannot come live in Israel. And this has been in place for, I think 15 years, maybe a little bit more. And
every year it needs to be renewed. Right, right, yeah.
Yes, and the coalition is having trouble getting the votes together to renew it. Now, Likud, the Haredi parties, the Religious Zionist Party, they all, in theory, support this law. They always have. But, of course, they want to give the coalition a hard time. And the coalition relies on the votes of Ra'am, which is the Islamist party, which also overwhelmingly represents Bedouins in the Negev who often marry Palestinians. And so they do not support this law. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes moving forward. You know, it could be there's all these charts showing, you know, how many Israeli Arabs married Palestinians before and how many. And it could be a security risk. I mean, that's the thing, that there's a security issue here. So
I wonder, though, if that can't be managed. I wonder if that can't be managed. Right. I mean, you know, there's something that doesn't. There's a saying in Hebrew, right? It doesn't go down your throat smoothly, you know?
Right.
But like the fact that a Jew can go outside of Israel, marry even a non-Jew, bring that person to Israel and immediately, you know, not immediately, obviously there's a process, but that person will get citizenship or status or residency or whatever it is. But an Israeli Arab who wants to marry a Palestinian cannot is slightly, it's problematic, right? And is it a legal issue that needs to be looked at? And I know that there are obviously security risks, and this law that you mentioned that needs to get renewed every year, it was instituted, if I'm not mistaken, during the Ariel Sharon premiership back in the early 2000s when Israel was really facing off the Second Intifada. And that was a very serious concern at the time because this was being used, these reunifications, for nefarious purposes. But I wonder if Israel can't manage this a little differently today. And you think about the backdrop of the Sheikh Jarrah situation, where also that's going to be coming towards a decision in August in about a month and a bit, when the court will have to decide, are they evicting these dozens of Palestinian families or not? And also there you have a situation of, you know, again, this could be a 2-hour conversation of itself, but it's Palestinians who had to flee their homes in parts of Jerusalem and Haifa and Jaffa after the 48 war, settled, found themselves in Jordan, were given a piece of land in Jordan to build homes on. 67 comes, Israel unifies and liberates East Jerusalem and reunites this capital. And they can't go back to their homes, but the Jews who had owned that land prior to 48 can demand to receive their land back. That's also something that when you think about it for a moment, there is a connection here. And Israel's got to figure this stuff out.
I think that it's conflating two different things, because I think there's like Israel doesn't want to create a sort of de facto recognition of the quote unquote right of return of Palestinians. You know, like, where does it end when you start letting people come back to places that they lost in war? Like, at the end of the day, war has consequences, and Israel won these wars, and they're wars that we didn't really start. But the marriage thing is something that I think is, you know, maybe there's a way to go by it and to do it in a more humane way and look at things at a more case by case basis.
By the way, I agree with you definitely about the war situation. I just think that when you look at these two things that are happening all at the same time, it does look like a clear across the board discrimination. Right. And that's something that Israel does need to clarify and make sure that that's not the case. Right. That I don't think that that's Israel. I know that's not Israel, but I think that we do also have to explain and show that that's not Israel to the world. And that's something that we could do. We have a great interview coming up with Professor Shaul Horev. But just a word about who Shaul Horev is. We had a fascinating conversation with him. He now runs a maritime policy and research center at Haifa University, where he was, he used to serve as the deputy head of the Navy, but from 2007 to 2017, he was the director general of Israel's Atomic Energy Commission. So the guy knows a lot about nuclear stuff, and is probably one of the foremost Israeli experts on particularly Iran's nuclear program. So we spoke to him about where Iran is in its nuclear program, what they've developed, what they have accumulated right now, and what the concerns are with the return to the JCPOA, or a bigger, stronger, longer deal, as the Biden administration likes to call it, what Israel could potentially get out of the Americans, and what are the pitfalls that it needs to look for along the way. Shaul Horev coming up. Here we go. So we're honored to have with us Professor Shaul Horev, the Director of Maritime Policy and Strategy Research Center at the University of Haifa. And Professor Horev is also the former head of Israel's Atomic Energy Commission, so he knows a thing or two about nuclear developments around the world, and is the former deputy head of the Israel Navy. He served as the head of the Atomic Energy Commission from 2007 into 2015. Professor Horev, our pleasure to have you join us at the Jerusalem Post podcast. And we wanted to talk about what's happening in Iran right now, right? We know that Iran has amassed quite a stockpile of thousands of kilograms of low-enriched uranium. We're told by Israeli intelligence officials, as well as Americans and other Western sources, that if they wanted to, it could maybe be a matter of months for them to enrich uranium to what's highly enriched uranium to develop a nuclear weapon. But we also know is that they've recently had elections and elected a new president. So maybe you could kind of just give us, where do they stand right now in terms of their program? How urgent is all of this? And what does the election of the new president mean for the nuclear talks that are ongoing?
First of all, I think that since the withdrawal of President Trump, unilaterally withdrawal, from the JPOC, then Iran continue its enrichment program. And when we are speaking about two main routes to the nuclear device, they selected naturally to concentrate on the enrichment. If they were allowed by the agreement that they have to have only about 300 kilograms of low enrichment uranium, this is 3.67%. Currently, they have more than 3,200 kilograms in low enrichment uranium. So there are, and I should mention that there are some activities related something to Israel and other to disturb them, but with the route to enrich uranium, they achieve almost 63 kilogram of 20% uranium. And if they would like to go to the 90%, I think that the route is quite short. What is more concerned is that they have now what we call a metal uranium, because you know that when we are speaking about enrichment, we are speaking about the gas, HF6. And right. to transfer this gas to metal, it's a process. And currently they have more than 2.5 kilogram of metal uranium, which make up a concern because the path to the nuclear device is shorter. But anyway, I'm not sharing the idea of the U.S. Secretary of State that it's about 3 to 4 months that they can reach to a device. I think it's about 8, 9, 10 months, and they are using the opportunity that they haven't yet signed the agreement to get more and more enriched material, because when you are going to negotiate, you are in better position when you have such amount of enriched uranium. But I should mention also that from the enriched uranium to get the device, they have a way to go to produce the device, then to assemble it on the missile. But we should know that to do such a thing, it's not a very, let's say, a hectic job for them, because the missile by itself, we know that it has the capability, and that's the reason that beside the JCOA agreement, there is a Security Council decision that they will have to stop their program with the delivery system, which are the missiles. And I think that this aspect, we can assume that it will take them less than a year, but they are reaching a point that they are reaching a stage that they will have the capability to enrich to higher percentage, which is more than 80%, which brings them closer to the device. In this aspect, I think that the last election for Iran's new president and the nuclear deal, everything in this aspect is dependent on the supreme leader. And even though Ibrahim Raisi is an ultra-conservative and not, we can't compare him to Rouhani, which is a reformer, but I think that once the supreme leader have decided that he would like to go to a deal with the U.S. or point P5 plus one, that's the aim, that's the objective. And even though Ibrahim Raisi is a ultra-conservative, will not change this decision. The only one in Iran who can change the decision is the supreme leader, Khamenei.
How soon do you estimate that Iran and the U.S. will reach a deal? Because it seems that if Iran has been in these negotiations for so long, then they do want to return to the deal.
There are some conflicting news about this. The director of the IAEA, Mr. Grossi, evaluated that there will be no negotiation till Mr. Raisi will assemble his new government. But I am not sure that this is the way, because they can continue the negotiation, and it might be before he will assemble the government in the middle of August or the beginning of August. So I think that now that everybody knows what are the results of this election, there will continue negotiation in Vienna. It's not a direct negotiation, but they will try to continue the negotiation. This is my evaluation. Anyway, we are coming very close to August either way.
And what happens in August?
In August, they will assemble the government and Iran. And if we can believe to what Mr. Grossi said, they will not start the negotiation before August. But I think that they will continue the negotiation, even though the government will not be assembled.
Right.
Another issue is, you know, that the IAEA has an agreement, inspection safeguard agreement with the Iran. And they seized this agreement, and they are continuing this agreement for months. Every month they continue this agreement. So let's see what will be the next step of Iran with the inspection safeguard of the IAEA in their facilities, because there are also some unanswered questions in areas that are a clandestine area that the IAEA found some uranium isotopes, and they haven't yet answered the IAEA question concerning what is the origin, what is the purpose. We are not speaking about Natanz, we are not speaking about other places, because it's other facilities or other places that this uranium was discovered. So with the inspection that the IAEA is doing in Iran, they seize it and they are continuing months by month.
I wanted to ask you, it's a bit of a technical question, but we know that right under the 2015 nuclear deal, they were supposed to have stopped in terms of what they were enriching uranium. They were allowed a certain amount, but they were allowed to continue to do research and development of more advanced centrifuges. And what we've seen since the U.S. pullout of the deal is the installation of those new centrifuges, which apparently, I'm reading, spin 4 or 5 times faster than the older models, what they had back in 2015. And that is also a big point of concern, right? Because it means that they can potentially cut down the breakout time and move to a bomb faster. Is that the correct assessment?
Yes, you're definitely right. I think that during the negotiation in 2015, our former prime minister didn't want that we would not participate, but that we will put our input into the negotiation. And we, I mentioned that Israel Atomic Energy Commission foresee what is the danger of giving them the opportunity to develop, let's say, a more advanced centrifuge. Because you are right in your assessment. If you have more advanced centrifuges, which are operating in a higher speed, longer, they can produce more fissile material as the one that they are operating now. So I think that one of the pitfalls in this agreement is the development of a new centrifuge, which can give them later in the future the capability to shorten the path of enrichment by, let's say, by a time of 4 or 5.
So with the talks ongoing between the U.S. and Iran, the indirect talks, the U.S. seems determined to return to the deal. How can Israel, or is there even a way that Israel can convince, can make the deal better for Israel and not as bad? Is there, what should Israel be asking the U.S. for?
I think that we have some kind of a pause, because the talks in Vienna cease for, let's say, a week, two. And as I try to estimate, we have some kind of, let's say, pause in the negotiation. And I think that in Israel, we have a new government. And I realize they are trying to do it in one way or other, to try and to approach the U.S. to be involved what might be the terms of the new deal, to indicate what, for us, the last deal may cause dangers for Israel or for the whole world, and to insist, as we can do, because it's not a negotiation between us and Iran, but insist during the good bilateral relations that we have with the U.S. that they will take care of all these pitfalls that we indicated in the past.
How realistic is that, though, Professor Khorev, that that you know, we saw what happened in 2015. Then the policy seemed to be by then Prime Minister Netanyahu to openly fight with the administration as opposed to try to work behind the scenes, as far as we know publicly, right, to influence the deal. So you're saying now there's an opportunity maybe to influence in this window But how much is Biden and his people willing to listen to Israel? They want a deal. Israel's requests are going to make it more difficult to reach one, right? We're going to want ballistic missiles. We're going to want the terrorism proxies dealt with. We're going to want no sunset clause. We're going to want the advanced centrifuges taken out. And the Iranians might not accept that.
First of all, you are definitely right. We should realize that this is the objective of the Biden administration. And we can't fight them. They have an objective and they will reach it. So the only way or venue that we can do it through try by the people, the technical people, as well as the people from the intelligence to understand them, to explain them what are the pitfalls. I think that doing it in such a way, it might give us some kind of a chance. Secondly, I think that there is a new administration in Israel. And this new administration, the U.S. Objective is that there will be in a good relation with them. And you can see it when our foreign minister, Mr. Lapid, mentioned to the U.S. that he would like to work with them cooperatively. It will be for the U.S. administration a good opportunity to do it. So I think that there is a win-win situation. I'm not sure, as you mentioned, that we will reach what we want in such an agreement, but at least we will try to amend it and improve it. I'm sure that if the Biden administration decided that they will want to sign such a deal, they will do it. We should be aware that the U.S. has some other objectives, some other priorities, especially against China, and also to understand that the U.S. is not the only superpower. And once the U.S. is trying to improve the deal with China, with Iran, China is signing with them some economic agreement, and it's not easy to handle such a process. So to summarize it, I think that for the U.S. administration and for the new Israeli administration, it's a good time to do with it. The U.S. administration will demonstrate that it wants to open a new way of negotiation with Israel, and Israel would like to see that they can, in some aspect, affect this negotiation.
Do you think that Israel's sort of new allies in the region, the UAE, Bahrain, others like Egypt that are worried about Iran, could work together with Israel towards that end?
Maybe I could just add to that question, Professor. You wrote an op-ed for the Jerusalem Post together with a couple former U.S. generals back in January about the move from the U.S. for Israel from EUCOM to the Central Command to CENTCOM, right? Which also ties into what Lahav just asked, kind of now that realignment, even in how the U.S. military looks at Israel.
Well, definitely right. We are speaking now on the operational level, because prior to what I mentioned, I spoke about strategic level. But I think that we shouldn't neglect the operational level. And once there is no, everybody in the region agrees that Israel will be part of the CENTCOM, Israel should know how to use the relationship with the CENTCOM to achieve its other objectives. I am looking at the maritime domain, and I see that there are problems of our trade to the Far East, which is going through the Red Sea, and also in the Arabic Sea, which the Israeli Navy can't reach, can't operate in this region. And if we would get some kind of coordination and cooperation from CENTCOM, the fifth link, and also some kind of support from moderate countries, like you mentioned, the UAE, and also countries in the Red Sea that are approaching Israel, like Sudan, we can change in the operational level the situation also, because in the other side, we have the Houthis, the Iranian proxies, that their aim is to change the operational situation in this region, and we should ignore it.
Lastly, we spoke a lot about Iran, but you've also been a very outspoken critic, I would say, or advocate for Israel to evaluate relations with China. And you've raised some alarm bells in recent years of how the Chinese government has been purchasing a lot of critical infrastructure in Israel, whether it's ports or power plants or bidding on tenders for the light rail in Tel Aviv and tunnels across the country. You know, that we know that Biden has spoke a lot about that recently at the G7 meeting that he had in the UK about how he wants to create a front against China and its aggressive moves, whether it's trade, war, or other aspects of international affairs. How much do you think Israel is kind of on board with the Biden administration, or is there still a long way to go?
First of all, I think that sometimes you have to say, I'm sorry to be right. And when we mentioned this issue that Israel should realize that China is an emerging superpower, and in some aspect it is the rival of the U.S., we should take in consideration, especially in, let's say, infrastructure and security infrastructure and other strategic infrastructure, that we should select side, take side. We can't ignore the China economic power. So I would like to differentiate between continuing some kind of commercial relation with China, because it will be good for the Israel economy, but in the strategic level, and especially when it's come to China activities in infrastructure that are security essential infrastructure to Israel, I think that the Israeli government come to a stage that it understood what it should, what side it should take. I think that the last visit of Secretary of State Pompeo, when the contract for the desalination facility,
right,
and Acheson was one of the companies that applied to it, gave the right message to the Israeli government that in such a situation you have to take sides. So it is a very complex situation that we could, we can't ignore China as a superpower. We can't ignore China's contribution to the economic strength of Israel. But in the strategic level, we should identify that the U.S. is our ally, and sometimes we have to select sides.
Professor Chorev, thank you very much for joining us. This has been fascinating. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jacob.
All right. Welcome to the Tweet of the Week. This week's tweet is from our foreign minister, Yair Lapid. A photo of a rainbow flag, an Israeli flag, and a flag with the symbol of the foreign ministry. And the text reads, "This morning, I instructed that the Pride flag be raised for the first time ever at the foreign ministry to mark Pride Month. The MFA and its employees bring a message of tolerance, unity, and freedom." So this is the first time that the LGBTQ pride flag has been raised outside the foreign ministry. June is Pride Month, and Friday, when this podcast will be going up, is the day of the big Tel Aviv Pride Parade that takes place every year. Very colorful, always a lot of fun. Usually a huge, huge tourist draw, but of course, for the second year in a row, we don't really have tourists coming, so it'll be probably a more staid affair than usual. But there have been parades in Jerusalem, in Beersheba, mostly uneventful, but I mean uneventful in the sense of, you know, opposition, which sometimes can get out of hand, to say the least. But there has been some opposition to Lapid's move on the far right in the Knesset. Itamar Ben-Gvir from the Kahanist faction in the Knesset said, "Oh, I don't have a problem with gay people," right? That's always not a great start to a sentence, because then you wonder, when does the other foot drop? So the other foot dropping is that he feels like this sets a bad example for children. It's a politicized message that shouldn't be on a national institution. He wrote a letter to the Attorney General complaining, saying that Lapid can't use the foreign ministry to promote partisan politics. So far, the Attorney General has not responded. Pride Month is over in a week, I'm guessing.
Does Idan Roll, who's the deputy foreign minister, does he play a role in this? Right? Let's just remind people he's a member of Yesh Atid, Lapid's party. He's gay, right? His partner is a famous singer, right? Am I right about
yes.
that?
Yes. His partner yes. is Harel Scott, who was on Kochav Nolad, like Israel's version of American Idol, popular singer. Yeah. And they have a baby.
And they have a baby, Mazel Tov. But he's also in the foreign ministry, so maybe that has a role. But I think it's also the way I kind of looked at that tweet, Lahav, was Lapid basically marking territory, right? And now that the Haredim are out of the government and those far right elements are out of the government, waving the pride flag is a way of saying this is a new administration in Jerusalem. This is a new government.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, Yesh Atid has the slogan, Banu Lashanot, we came to make a change. So this is definitely them showing that they're making a change. Although I will say, even though there was never a flag in the foreign ministry in Jerusalem before, a lot of Israeli embassies abroad have emphasized gay rights in Israel and have taken part in gay pride events and things like that. That part is not new. But, you know, Lapid is showing sort of leadership in that way on that issue.
Well, what happens outside of Israel doesn't bother people like Itamar Ben-Gvir or the ultra-Orthodox parties as much as it when it happens in the center of Jerusalem at the foreign ministry. But yeah, we'll wait to see how that plays out next week.
Thank you for tuning into the Jerusalem Post podcast. We'll be here again next week.